Hello everyone, so welcome back to the Impact Lab podcast. I am delighted to have an old friend with me, not so old, old in terms of how long we've been friends, not so old in terms of age, Chris Avril. How are you doing, Chris?
Very good, Aziz. Nice to see you and thank you for inviting me along.
It's my pleasure. The audience are going to get an awful lot from your vast experience and knowledge. But as is tradition, before we start, let's do the reverse Turing test. So Chris, you wrote a book. What is the title of that book?
Okay, you ready for my answer?
Yeah, go for it.
Build, Sell, Retire.
Build, Sell, Retire. Yeah. So hopefully that proves that we're human, but who knows? Maybe one day AI will be so good that they'll even be able to fake my handwriting. Who knows? Chris, I'm going to jump straight in. So the point of this podcast is to get to the nuts and bolts of what is success and how do you decode it? What are the things that make an impact? You are someone who I've known like professionally and personally for a long time. You've built businesses, you've exited a business, you're in the process of building another business. So let's talk about right at the start, early stages. And I'm going to take us back to your experience. Like, I'm going to take you back down memory lane for a bit. If you were starting out, like, what are the things that in those early days really made a difference?
I guess there's two answers to that question. One is, what would I do differently? And one is, what did I do? So I think what I was good at, what worked well for me, and I didn't know it at the time, was being able to pick great people. So being able to identify really good talent and hire really smart people, and they built the business. You know, as a founder, you're nothing without your team. I know that sounds very cheesy, but it's something that I did and I didn't realize. So a bit of luck. I guess what would I do slightly differently would be to recognize everyone's ability sooner and do less hands-on. And I was pretty hands-on until the last day. Which then holds down the ability of some, you know, my team to develop and grow and be independent and, you know, take charge. So yeah, definitely being able to spot talent and hire great people is a key.
I want to talk a little bit about that, the desire to move away from the hands-on day-to-day stuff, because I had that desire every day, every morning, every hour, every second to move away from like the day-to-day hands-on stuff. But I always feel like when I do step away, I kind of feel like however hard I've tried to, engender my own philosophy in marketing, there's always something a little bit missing. Did you ever come across that?
Yeah. I mean, I do today. I did all the way through the business. I did during the last 7 years of coaching, leadership coaching that I've been undertaking, and with my new venture, I'm very conscious of it. So I think the good thing is you're aware of it. I'm interviewing you now. The great thing is you're aware of it. And awareness is the first step in improving, in self-improvement. And you're a master at what you do, which is why you're running a business doing it, and successfully running a business doing it. So it's hard to not impart that experience all the time and not to just step back and let people fail. And failure is the only way that you learn on your journey, and the only way that I learned, and the only way your teams will learn. So I guess what I constantly do when I coach and I do myself is apply active listening, listen, don't speak, and to allow people to fail, make failure part of the culture, reward people for failure, and not penalize them for failure. And that goes in the face of most corporate cultures. They don't really do failure because, yeah, it's not an option.
Yeah, I absolutely love that, because it's like listening to my team are going to hear this podcast and they're going to think that they're going to finally understand where I got this mentality from. Because I say this all the time. I say, like, the school system, the university system, corporate life is designed to punish failure. But failure is a mandatory milestone to success.
Yeah. Except that most places don't reward failure. They only reward success. And their view of success is typically very boxed and structured, and doesn't, particularly in the world of creatives. You know, we think differently, we act differently, we solve problems differently. So, you know, our route through education and development is typically very different from more straightforward people.
You mentioned active listening. Then just give people an overview. Like, I'm very much into active listening, and I've always got my notepad next to me. But if you're starting out in your career, take it from us, active listening is really critical. But what are some practical steps to start the process of active listening?
So active listening can save your career and also your marriage or relationship. It's that powerful. It can move you from nowhere to the top of a business. And I've used it successfully myself, and I've taught it, and I have literally had people come back and say, it's saved my marriage. It has been that helpful for me to realise, you know, what I'm doing. So really simple steps active listening is when you're meeting with somebody, know what you're going into the meeting for and clear your mind before you go in. Don't go in thinking about what happens in the next meeting. It's particularly important for managers because they're rushing around doing lots of things. So just be there, be present in the moment for that person, and very gently ask them some questions. Let them talk with no real agenda. Let that person open up. Don't answer to or respond to those statements. Don't try and be defensive. Don't try and answer them. Don't be the boss. Don't be the Swiss Army pen knife and come up with a million solutions. Just say, okay, I understand. Or that must be very difficult. Or that's brilliant. Take note, ideally in your mind, of the key things that are being said. Play those key things back as they are said, but literally one or two words. And then finish the meeting, say thank you very much, and walk out. And then spend the next 20 minutes downloading what's been said, what's the underlying problem or opportunity, what do I need to do next, how do I empower that person to move out of where they are, and then come back to that person, you know, at a suitable time and talk to them about what's gone on and ask them what they want to do about it and how I can help. So and that works just as well at home as it does in the workplace. And it's what we don't do as managers, as leaders. We typically jump in and firefight. And I'll just finish it with an actual story from my business, from We Are Experience. So brilliant, one of my team members who's absolutely awesome, Stephanie Taylor, strategist. I was chatting to her and she said, Chris, sometimes I'm waving, not drowning. And I said, well, what do you mean, Steph? And she said, I ask you a question and you will answer that question. But I'm not asking a question for you to answer it. I'm asking you to listen, to give me some direction, to challenge me on what I'm doing and give me some food for thought. You're always right, and that's very frustrating, but I want to be right. And that's when I first really clicked that I'm just solving everyone's problems and I'm not actually listening and letting them solve their own.
I love that, waving, not drowning. That's really cool. I'm going to throw a term at you that you may not know that you've invented, active pitching, moving from active listening to active pitching. And so, you know, when I modeled Coach Digital's pitch process, I modeled it on the We Are Experience pitch that you gave us, where it was the only active pitch that I've been involved in as a client on the client side, whereby you really engaged us in the nuts and bolts of how to solve the problem we were presenting to you. How did you come up with that?
Just say that last bit again, sorry.
How did you come up with the whole active pitch process?
Do you know, nothing in life is new. So I was working with Barclays and there was a pitch for the complete redesign of all their digital properties, full, like the whole world. It was all disparate. And we did a pitch. I actually flew back from holiday in the Channel Islands to come and pitch, and the pitch was all right. It wasn't brilliant, but the team that won it did an amazing job. They had an absolutely incredible job. And what they did is they'd mapped out on a piece of paper the whole universe of Barclays. Massive, great thing, and a massive piece of brown paper. And they rolled it across the boardroom table, and it was this beautiful sketch diagram. And the creative director stood up, or the head of digital stood up, and they got all of the Barclays clients to stand up, and they all looked around. They're all surprised and shocked about how disparate it was and what's where and who owns that, and no one knew. And they'd won the work just by engaging everybody in the real problem in a creative way. So when my client told me about it, I wasn't massively disappointed. It was probably a bit of a big project for us to win at the time. But I walked away going, I'm never going to do a slide presentation, just static slides again. I'm not going to do, you know, answer the proposal in just a very boring way. We're going to be part of your team. So let's kick off a pitch by being part of your team. And if you like us, you like the look of us, you like the smell of us, you know, you'll pick us. If you don't, then we couldn't have done anything else.
Time for a quick message from this episode's sponsor. On the Impact Lab, we're constantly talking about real impact. The kind that protects is what matters most. That's why I want to tell you about Dar al-Himaya. They are based in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and are a leader in early warning and fire protection systems. They offer comprehensive safety solutions across the kingdom, from advanced fire alarms to sprinkler systems and critical industrial safety. They're not just selling products, they are safeguarding futures. So to secure your world, visit their website. The link is in the show notes. All right, back to the show. Yeah, and it was really, really effective, in certainly in our case. In our, I think we must have interviewed 8 or 9 agencies at that time, and you guys were so far ahead, just because that process of engaging us and having us as part of the problem-solving exercises made us feel like, okay, so these guys aren't going to come just with a solution. They're going to come with expertise and help us together as a team solve the problems that are in front of us. And, you know, the product we created was amazing. So, you know, I think that... If you think about it, I think about this sometimes. Eva, by the way, was the app that we were creating. This was 2015, I think. And we had essentially, through that process, through our experience and our own internal teams, we had invented Reels, because there was no vertical video at that time, if you remember. Even on YouTube, yeah. When you turned horizontally, you had vertical video, just be down the middle. We'd invented filters, filtering on video. We'd invented, like, essentially the scrolling, the constant scroll. All of these things were invented in that war room with you and your team. And I think it's a testament to the process that you'd created. One of the challenges that all new business owners or business owners in general face is client acquisition. Do you have any tips for people who are facing the challenge of client acquisition? How did you do it?
I've got to find 1,500 customers for my new business in the next 8 weeks. So how do we do it? Sales is the most important thing of any business. And the sooner people realize that, the sooner you will be successful. And success doesn't mean masses of money and wealth. You know, you've been successful in everything you do, and this venture you're in now started off in a very different place than where it is today. But that's what success looks like. You can help more people by building, you know, an agency that's able to give an outreach to those who aren't able necessarily to get through a normal, you know, agency route. So I think sales is critical, and the best way to sell is to really understand your audience and your product and service. So if you can really simply summarize the old elevator pitch, what it is you do, and when people ask you to validate your claim, then you can very simply say this is how it's validated. But more importantly, everyone in your team can do the same thing. And that's where most sales fail in business, because the founder knows the business inside out, but no one else does. That's not documented. There's no onboarding process to train people in. This is what the company is all about. When I was at Arthur Andersen back in the 90s, I was the last year of intake. I joined as an experienced hire. And I was the last intake where they didn't go to St. Charles, which is their university in Chicago. So Andersen's had a whole university campus, and every new joiner went and did an indoctrination course on what is Arthur Andersen, how do you discuss it, how do you pitch it, how do we work. And it sounded a bit weird, but you know what, it's brilliant, because they were one of the most successful consultancies until a incident with an energy company in America, but we won't talk about that. But it was, they had the idea, then consultancies do have that, they know you've got to onboard people, train people, get everyone saying the same thing, because then you get consistency. And but more importantly, I'm comfortable selling the business, the product, the service, because I know what it is. I believe in it, and so you believe in me if I believe in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've struggled with that. I've made that mistake through this journey, you know, not focusing enough on bringing, sort of onboarding people onto the ultimate vision. And, like, you know, I think that, you know, the moment I realized that that was a gap, things kind of became a lot easier. I had, like, a lot of my workload suddenly disappeared. As hire good people and let them be great, I guess, is the message from there. So last question on your past, because I want to talk obviously about the future. Really, that's why we're connected. A lot of companies are sort of stuck in this sort of 5 to 20 employee space. That they're struggling to sort of scale past that late startup phase. Any tips for how to get past that point?
So most of my coaching has been focused on really the two biggest issues people face is growth and revenue. So we touched on the sales one. And the next one is growth. How do we grow? How do we get past that number of people? And there are two parts to it. One is founders are the bottleneck of all businesses. It's as simple as that. Most founders hold the whole company back, throttle the company by being what we've just talked about, too hands-on, or the only person who deals with sales. They, you know, I don't trust anyone else to have the client relationships. So those things really affect a business growth. And the other part, so if you can free the founder up, or as the founder, you'll free yourself up, trust your team, and you invest in sales. You know, it's not going to happen by luck. You've got to invest in it, be that hiring people, be that buying lists of contacts with phone numbers and getting people phoning them up to open up opportunities. The other side is investment and not investing early enough or soon enough to grow the company. And that investment typically is in people and having the right people in place to allow you to scale, the right people in place to allow you to step into a different role as the founder. And so you can do more conferences, more events, more speaking opportunities. I'm seeing someone tomorrow who runs an amazing luxury brand business called Matter of Form. And he was saying, Nant was telling me that he spends most of his time, you know, at conferences talking for clients and to clients because he's become an expert. Now, that's it. I mean, that's an amazing way of selling. You know, you're being invited, paid to talk about what you're selling. Wow. So I would definitely say, don't be a throttle on the business and invest earlier to allow you to have the right team in place to scale. If you leave it too long, you'll just do boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust, and always be stuck at those points.
Great advice. Love that. Again, all the traps that I've fallen for. I think that maybe the thing that you're too polite to say there is that as founders, our egos get in the way sometimes. And like, I've had that myself. You know, I've had the situation where I'm like, oh, no one can do it like me. Truth is, I'm nothing special and people can do basically everything that I do, maybe with the exception of like the strategic long-term thinking part. So I think my ego probably got in the way of my own growth in the past.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And even the strategic long-term thinking, what we've rerun with our the companies I coach is we create a growth team. And the growth team is made up of ideally the most junior people in the business. And you invite them to come in and the board or the leadership team set just growth targets over 3 years. We want to get to 50 million in 3 years and we're at five now. Right. How many people do we think we need? What's the budget each year? And then kind of break into quarters and months. But what you have is a series of tasks which equate to a strategy. And then you get this young, you know, thoughtful, not afraid because they've never failed team to start to answer some of those questions and actually to start to develop the strategy for the business. And you're much more likely to succeed with them in place. And you talk about, you know, you bring, is an internship scheme you run or a training scheme you run? You know, yeah. When I run my internship scheme, they were, sorry, everyone else in the business, but they were pretty much the best people we ever hired. And they hadn't come with experience or years in the industry. So I think, you know, even strategy and future business can be done by your, set by your team. And you're there to listen. You're there to guide. You're there to support. You're there to, you know, that's it. Your leadership is not any, no decision making, actually, just to listen to everyone else and give them support to succeed or fail and carry on.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely love that. And I feel like this has turned a bit into a coaching session, and I thank you because I'm not paying you for it. because, you know, I feel a lot of resonance to what you're saying. You know, that's actually what I feel passionate about isn't actually growing a business. I don't feel like growing a business for me is just the thing that I can do if I have to do, but I don't really want to do. What I love doing though, what gets me up in the morning is growing people. Helping people grow in their own thought processes. I love that. And that's, there's a lot of value in what you said there. Chris, the reason we actually connected today is because if you all aren't following Chris on LinkedIn, you should. And his links, all of his links will be in the show notes. Please do follow him on LinkedIn. Is because of your, I don't know if it's recent, but certainly you've spoken about it recently, engagement with AI and using of AI, and then the subsets of people that come out from that all, how they view AI. So without guiding the conversation, I'm just going to ask you, what has your experience been using AI?
Okay, so for the record, I'm not entirely sure what AI actually is in the tools that I use. And I was told off by a lady who was very smart, used to work for Autonomy and sold her business for £1 billion last year, an AI credit card fraud detection system. And she said, it's not AI, what you're all doing. AI is what I did. And we've been doing AI for years. And I said, well, total respect, and she's an amazing lady. I said, but the difference is that we can use it on our phones, and when you started using it, you needed supercomputers. So, you know, I think what's my experience and exposure? I was a bit afraid of it to start with, and then I started using Copilot because Microsoft got out an app early on the iPhone, and I loved it. Speak to it, speaks back, friendly, nice. I mean, I'm an interface designer, as you know. I've done it all my life. And for years, I've been saying voice will be the only interface that we will ever use eventually, unless we plug into our brains and do it without thinking. But I think that's a way off. So I loved Copilot. And so I've probably gone to Copilot about, I don't know, whenever it launched, 18 months ago, something like that, 2 years ago. It showed loads of people loved it, and loads of people were blown away by it. And then I played around with a few more tools, but it wasn't until I met a friend's nephew who just finished his a master's in AI at King's, and I was doing a little bit of just kind of support, helping him, you know, and used him with a client of mine or a good friend of mine, and they were blown away. I was blown away. Just a genius, this guy, Oscar. Amazing. So we set up a business together, and I learned a lot about AI, and we were looking to build a sort of workplace agentic automation tool to take away 70% of what you do in life, or the rubbish, the planning, the organization, the filing. But Oscar's vision is much bigger than that. So he wanted to go off to LA and build a startup in a much bigger capacity. So I let him, we decided it would be best for him to do that, and I'll, you know, take a step back. And at the time, I was a bit disappointed, but then I thought, I'm retired and I don't need a full-time job. And then I fell in love with olive oil. And then I used all my knowledge of AI to build my olive oil business. So I wouldn't say I'm the world expert, but with agentic tools, I have used a lot. I mean, I use probably 30 tools a day, 20 or 30 tools a day, different tools for jobs. And I watch a lot of YouTube and learn most of my knowledge from YouTube.
You're not alone in that. Look, I want to say, you know, you mentioned at the start of the answer there that you've been saying for a long time that voice is the future. It will be the only interactions that we use, the only interface that we use. 2015, before Alexa, you said that to me directly. You said the future of interfaces is voice. And I remember thinking, I don't know, he's smarter than me, so I'm going to take his word for it. But I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm going to feel comfortable doing that. But you are right, and you remain right. So look, your experience has been super positive. So why are people scared of it?
Why are people scared of AI? People are scared of change. Right? People don't like change. I mean, from running my business days to coaching, everyone fears change. We like to be comfortable. We like to do what we do. And AI represents a massive fundamental shift in workplace culture, in home life, in security, in trust, in planning. You know, what am I going to do in my life? What are my kids going to do? So I think a lot of people, and I was a bit fearful to start with, but I was also fearful of it making mistakes, which it still does. But I was less fearful about my kind of life ending, the not having a job. So I think a lot of people are just put off by AI. There's also a lot of misinformation. There's not necessarily very robust government strategies about how AI integrates into the economy, and businesses are fearful. You know, suddenly people are bringing in AI tools without permission into corporates, downloading sensitive data and sharing it with an LLM that is open to anyone. So there is a lot to be not fearful of, but I think mindful is the phrase I would use. And that's, I think, why a lot of people just don't use it. You know, they just don't know how to.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that one of the episodes that I do, it's a solo episode every month, is called What the F Did AI Just Do? And I just basically go through the top 10 crazy things AI did in the last month. And a lot of the stories are around that when I'm doing the research, a lot of the stories around, oh, AI is going to replace so many people. And it's like, yeah, but okay, but haven't we gone through that process over and over again in our history, in human history? Technology advances. People, you know, technology takes over certain menial roles. People upgrade themselves and they take on bigger roles. And that's like just the circle of our own existence. It's almost like we're in, We're designed to invent stuff to make our lives easier and to make our lives better. And I see AI in the same place. I think that you're right. Like, mostly the fear stems from a lack of information or misinformation. And there is an awful lot of lack of information and misinformation. But one of the groups, obviously, that I'm really close to are graduates. And one of the fears that I have for AI usage, I use AI every single day. I mean, it's an integrated part of my day-to-day life. But one of the fears that I have is that I come to AI with, you know, 25 years of marketing experience behind me, and I'm able to negotiate with the AI itself and correct it when it's wrong and spot, just a simply spot when AI is wrong. And what I'm seeing now is a trend of graduates coming into our business who are blindly following AI without building the foundational skills. So what advice do you have for people who are sort of starting out their career to build those foundational skills, particularly in marketing?
Yeah, I think very straightforward, use AI before AI uses you, which is pretty much summarizing what you've just said. And it's a line I used at this conference earlier in the year, and then a few people have adapted it to their signature on their email, which is quite nice. So I think you've got to just be in it. You've got to understand the tools, understand how they work, and understand limitations. And you do need, at the current time, a certain level of knowledge of the work that the tool is doing to be able to sense check it, to be able to make sure that it's not coming up with, you know, something rubbish. It's like, I don't know, I use no-code website design. I've just built this website. And a lot of people I talk to who are coders just laugh because they're like, do you know how much many extra lines of code it creates? Do you know how slow it is? Do you know how complex it is? Do you know, which is all fair comments. And you know, I'm sure they'd be horrified if they looked at it. So I do, and I know a little bit about coding, so I know enough to be able to go in and tweak and change and fix. But you would only get a simple product out of it. So if I left school today and decided to be a website designer using agentic tools, I wouldn't get very far, in as much as I could only create fairly basic stuff, and then I wouldn't know what to do when it broke, when the agent can't tell me what's wrong and can't fix itself. Equally, it is accelerating incredibly quickly. So, you know, there's a world where the tools are probably moving fast in our ability to learn, and there will be a day when you probably don't need to know quite so much to be able to quiz it. But, you know, I also know that, you know, Cloudflare are putting brakes on access to most websites, quite rightly, to stop the agentic crawlers just stripping all the data and spitting out as theirs. So even now, the value of a lot of AI tools will be slowing and diminishing because it just hasn't have access to real-time information.
Yeah, I think that that's probably one of those misconceptions people don't quite understand, is that AI is essentially built on human information. And therefore, if the flow of human information stops, then the growth of the AI itself stops. But it's a good point. And I'm going to use this moment to shamelessly plug our free course on the impactlab.store. Totally free. And it's called the Monkey Prompt Dilemma. And the monkey prompt dilemma is basically, because I see people prompting like and then just churning out those outputs as if they're work, as opposed to really sitting down and understanding. And in that course, what I'm training people to do is to use AI to build their foundational knowledge, right? And with just really simple techniques. If you run a prompt, like, you know, help me build a marketing strategy for Olive, for example, and then you see back from that prompt words or concepts or ideas that you don't understand, then in this course, what I've got is a set of prompts for you to let the AI teach you those foundational facets, those foundational things. So if it says, you know, you should target a persona based like da-da-da-da-da, and you don't really know what a persona is, then these prompts will get the AI to teach you what a persona is, so that as you're using the AI, you're also building foundational knowledge. And I think that it's going to be increasingly important that people build that the grads, that they start to build that foundational knowledge with them. One of the areas...
I think it's great. I think you're absolutely spot on. I hadn't even thought about it like that. It's like, how do you use AI to teach me how to accelerate my knowledge so that I can use the agentic tools better.
One of the things that I think AI currently struggles with, but will probably get a lot better at, is right in your wheelhouse, and it's UX. So where do you think AI is now in terms of its ability to fully understand user experience? And do you think that there's room for like real innovation in that space?
Oh, it's such a good question, to use an Americanism. That's an excellent question. It's a really interesting challenge. And what I've been going through with this building this olive oil business, some of the stuff you can do creatively, brilliant, love it. Like, it just comes up with solutions I hadn't thought of. But then it hits a barrier, and it can't translate. And I know what good looks like, but I'm not a great designer. So the agentic tool is fantastic for me because I can translate my vision into reality using a tool. And I can pop around to other websites, and I can find other sites that have examples of things I like and drop those in. So it's pretty close. The risk is that if left to their own device, agentic tools will create optimized experiences, I think. Like the copy it creates is optimized. And it's a bit like the car industry. You know, why do all cars look the same? Because they're all run through similar code, drag efficiency, wind tunnel models, because they've got to be as slippery as possible, and they all look very Le Mans. Or they're copies of famous designs like a Range Rover Sport or a, you know, whatever, and everyone's taken the design cues to the point now where every car on the street looks the same. So I think creativity, there's a challenge. I did. So my first olive oil that we're launching, this isn't the shameless plug for olive, the first olive oil we're launching is a beautiful one from Spain, and it tastes of fig and cut grass and unripe tomato and artichoke. And I wanted to do some studio photography. So instead of going to a studio and photographing fruit or paying someone, I just asked Reeve, R-E-V-E, to create me a studio quality image of a cut tomato that's partly ripe. Now, I wrote it in a way that I knew I wanted a light sort of beige backcloth with very soft lighting and very soft shadow. And I knew what a studio photo looks like. So with that foundational knowledge, I could brief it to do a good job. And the output was amazing. So I show photographers and they have no idea it's AI. And the fruit, all of it is insane. I mean, incredible. So we're at an interesting place. Without knowing how to use it, your results were probably quite poor, or too many, you know, for you to go through, and you'll probably end up going back and asking someone who knows what they're doing to either use AI or photograph it for you. For basic design tasks, I mean, it's amazing. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, totally. And I think that that's only going to evolve, right? I look through the evolution, because we were really early in AI, you know, in the year 2000, yeah, the summer of 2000, we were using products built on GPT-3. So I look at the evolution of imagery and photography, well, firstly design and then imagery and photography. And now in terms of representation of real life, like photos and video, it's exceptional. It's exceptional. And that's why I start this podcast with the reverse Turing test, because even if it's not right now, by the end of this year or the start of next year, there will be full podcasts like this on video that are pure AI.
My Hey Gen.
There we go.
It's already there. My Hey Gen is already there. I mean, I use 11 labs for audio, and my family can't tell it's not me. Yep. And I'm just about to shoot another video for Hey Gen. For me, it's amazing. And now even Hey Gen, you can actually record audio. Like I record this, drop this audio file into Hey Gen, and then it lip syncs the model of me to that. So it's no longer text based; it will do it off a thing. And it's my voice, not an 11 Labs one.
Yeah,
I would say it wouldn't do that. It wouldn't pull funny faces. Yeah, it was getting close.
But therein lies the point, is that now it wouldn't do that. Now it wouldn't pull a funny face. But at some point in the future, it will. It will be so natural. So there has to be a way. Like, I really believe like that the future of look, we know as marketers how humans behave, right? They all flock toward where the latest new shiny thing is. And then their attention, then, you know, we as marketers, we overuse that channel. We use it way too much. And then people like, I'm not feeling that. And they go to another space. Like we did it with email. You know, when email came out, there was no such thing as spam filters. We as marketers, we created spam filters because we spammed people. That's what we do, right? We find a new channel. We screw it until like it's absolutely used up. and then the audience moves somewhere else. And I believe that that somewhere else will actually be human content. It'll be back to human content. It'll be back to face-to-face events, webinars, podcasts, real, like, human interaction. I want to come back to something that you said, right? Because I think it's really, really profound and really important. I know what good looks like, but I'm not a great designer. And I think what you're referring to there is the thing that AI can't necessarily replicate, and it's taste. You have taste, and I think what an AI can do is replicate taste, but not create taste. I think you either have, because not all humans have that capability that you have to spot beauty. Not everyone has that ability. What do you think?
No, I think it's a very astute observation, and I hadn't really thought about it like that when I said it. But it comes a bit to what you said earlier about needing a foundation, an understanding of stuff to be able to use these tools effectively. And I do think that authenticity is what we all strive for. We want to be, bizarrely, we want to be individual and all look the same. If we all wear Lacoste or we all wear Ralph Lauren or whatever it is, or, my kids all wear North Face jackets, puffer jackets, and the whole school is literally just like an advert for North Face. And in the hunt for authenticity, you end up being part of the crowd. And I think authenticity is hard to generate through algorithms, because it's very much down to a thought process, a way of imagining, a way of creating. I'm not saying AI can't and won't be able to do it, but it won't necessarily feel real, and it won't feel authentic to human beings. Maybe one day it will, and we'll be out of a job for creators. But no, I like the idea that great cars are designed by humans with a block of clay still, and they sculpt that clay and shape it and put it back and do that. Great clothes, great handbags, great shoes, are created by humans through, using their hands. I think that's the future of what we will always want and buy. But that might become a luxury, and the majority buy stuff like we do now. Like, it just, in my experience of olive oil, we're buying organic and regenerative farmed olive oil, but 90% of the world use olive oil that comes from intense farming, and that's pretty much robotic farming with chemicals, but we want it cheap. So if you want it cheap, it's going to be driven from AI. If you want it special, it's going to be created by humans.
Yeah, I think, I love that. Again, I think it's a turn of phrase that you've just thrown out without maybe being conscious of it. Like, I feel like today, as made in the UK or made in the USA has its own kudos, its own space, in the future, created by humans will also have its own kudos. Its own. I've got two more questions, and I'm going to set you free, right? So the first one, totally away from AI, right? You wrote a book. I want to understand why you chose to do it, and what was the process like? Like, were you apprehensive when you started? The book is called, the book is called Build, Sell, Retire. It's on Amazon all around the world, so go and buy it.
Yeah, please do. I wrote the book because I wanted to share my experience of selling the company and the M&A process, and I'd been in the world of marketing agencies, and it's always a hotbed of M&A. And it turned out that you don't need AI to create conspiracy theories. It turns out that humans are very capable of creating many conspiracy theories. And a lot of successful founders who'd sold businesses exited, it turned out they were just lying. Like, people weren't happy. People didn't make much money. People were hugely in debt. They wish they'd never sold. Even those who made money wish they'd not sold, because they sold the thing they love and they didn't know what to do. So I thought I'd write a book about my experience of selling, my experience of finding happiness after selling in retirement, and to kind of give it a bit of a backstory of how I grew up, with dyslexia and challenging at school, and succeeded even though everyone told me I'd be a failure. Literally everyone told me I'd be a failure, from my teachers to my parents to my friends. My tutor at college, I did a product design, industrial design course, but I spent most of my time doing animation. And he said, don't get a job in computers, you're not good enough. He's still a tutor at Plymouth Poly. So thanks. So that was the reason behind the book, was to really share my experience and help others learn. It wasn't sell any services. I wasn't coaching at the time. I didn't want to do anything. I was learning. I learned to fly, spending time with my family, getting fit, doing all that stuff that you do when you're sort of out of a job. The process was quite interesting. The first probably third of the chapters was fairly straightforward, and then I stumbled, and then I just had mental blocks, and I tried all techniques. There's like 400 lousy words a day, where you wake up every day and at some point in the day you have to write 400 words. Sometimes they're genius, sometimes they're awful. None of it worked. And I met a publisher, and an indie publisher called Taryn, and she helped me write my book. And she basically just told me to write stories, and then we'll work out the order of which they go into the book. So I scrapped chapters, wrote lots of stories about everything through my life, through my career, post, you know, during Sell and Post. And then we assembled it into some chapters. And I got an old buddy who used to be the editor of New Media Age, if you remember that magazine, physical magazine for a digital world, and Michael Nutley. And he did the copy editing and was brilliant. And then Michael and Taryn had a massive kind of argument about short form, long form. I left them to it, and at the end of it came my book. And it was relatively, in the end, relatively straightforward, but at the start, very challenging. So I'd never have finished it without those guys.
It's a hidden gem. I'm halfway through, and so I'm really enjoying it. I'm learning a lot from it, and I recommend everyone give it a read too. All right, Chris, thank you. I'm going to have one last question, right? Bit of a curveball. So imagine you're walking down the street in Covent Garden, and somehow you walk through a wormhole, walk into a pub, and your 25-year-old self is sat there at the bar. So you get to have the length of time it takes to drink a pint, not on a rugby tour, just a normal pint, yeah? What are you going to say to him?
Invest in NVIDIA. No, I'm joking. What would I say to him? What would I say to my former self? I would say, pretty much what we talked about in this. Like, I mean, I believed in myself. I mean, you know, I because people didn't believe in me, I believed in myself. Because I think of my dyslexia, I was always out to prove that I could do stuff and I didn't need to fit in to do it. But I think I tell myself that, you know, I should be nicer to people, those I work with and those I don't. I should, you know, make sure I create lots of time for myself and those around me, my family. And I should, you know, never stop learning and never stop enjoying work. And I do follow the latter bits. I've always enjoyed my work. And when I stopped enjoying it after the sale, but 2.5 years after I sold, I just left. You know, that was it. I was done and I left. And I had to leave Globen. And, you know, they're a brilliant acquirer, a great business to work with. I'm not saying that because they bought me. I loved working with them. But I got to a point where I was done. And so, you know, I think that the advice I would give myself is a lot of what I've lived. So, you know, make time for others, be nice to people. And if it's not right, do something else. You know, it's no one's holding a gun to your head.
Love it. Fantastic. Chris, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I know that our audience, by the way, most of our audience are in the GCC. The majority are in Saudi Arabia. Even though it's a relatively new podcast and the Impact Lab is relatively new, we've gotten like thousands of listeners in just the first few episodes. So I'm super excited about how this is going. And I know that they're going to get a lot of value from the lessons that you've been able to impart on them. So I want to take a minute just to say thank you for taking the time to do that today. Right.
Sure, as is.
So, guys, in the show notes are all of Chris's links, including his LinkedIn and link to his new business, which will be launching soon, as well as, of course, all of the links to the Impact Lab courses and the answer to the reverse Turing test. Thank you all for listening. And until the next episode, goodbye. Thank you. All right, before you go, just a quick message from me. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it made you think, maybe change your mind on a few things. If you want to reach out to us, my email and all of the links are in the show notes. Please do reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. Please, please, please take a moment. Wherever you heard this podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. It really helps get the podcast up and out into other people so that other people can benefit from the work that we're doing. I'd really appreciate if you took a minute just to do that. I wanted to share with you a couple of things just before we go in the last 30 seconds. The first thing is that, you know, the Impact Lab .store is where we have all of our courses. We've got a free course called the AI Trap. It's a free course designed to make sure that AI becomes your superpower and not your crutch. It's for anyone that's using AI and to help you really get an understanding of how to build your own core foundational competencies whilst using AI at the same time. There's also a paid course out there at the moment, which is the Impact Marketing System. This is our flagship course. If you are in marketing or if you are in business development or if you've got your own business, you really got to understand the foundations of what makes an impact in marketing and what are the core tenets of things that you need to do. The Impact Marketing System is the system that I have trained for over 10 years to get people from basically very novice marketers to become world-class marketers. And there are people all around the world, thousands of people who have done this course working at massive organizations or running their own very successful businesses, in part because of the things that they've learned through the Impact Marketing System. So please take the time to visit theimpactlab.store. If you're a brand in the GCC and you're looking for a digital marketing agency that'll cut through the noise and make a real impact on your business, then Kush Digital is your man. Go to kush.digital or you can email the team at contact@kush.digital. Kush is with the C-U-S-H.digital. Digital marketing, that makes an impact. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Don't forget to leave that review. Thanks a lot. See you at the next episode.